Committee on Human Resources, May 20, 1987, Hearing Room D, 1:30 p.m. Today there'll be a hearing on, there'll be a work session on House Bill 2067 and House Bill 2404, and then there'll be a public hearing and possible work session on SB 413, A. Gross, SB 879, A. Gross, and SB 522.
The House Human Resources Committee will come to order. We'll start with House Bill 2067, the Notorious Thieves Bill. And as you know, committee members know, we took it to the floor and discovered that perhaps there were some changes that we needed to make to it. So we brought it back to committee. In the meantime, the OMA and the Health Division and a number of other folks have been working to get us some amendments to it that might make the bill a little more acceptable. I've also asked the Corrections Division to be here to give us a little background on what they do in terms of AIDS at the state institution. So why don't we start? Do you have a list? Who do we want up here first?
You want
Christine
Corrections Gillian. Division.
And Scott out there. Gallant, there he is. Okay, why don't we ask Christy, why don't you come on up?
And the Corrections Division or something?
Not the corrections yet. I just want to talk about the amendments to the bill. Scott, do you want to, because you worked on them also. Was there anybody else, Christy, that should be up here that worked on them?
The ACLU also worked on those amendments. Stevie Remington's here today.
Okay. Stevie, where are you? Oh, okay. Do you want to come on up, Steve? Okay, we have some hand and gross amendments that'll be given to you right now, and we'll go through them. Now, Christy, before we start, I need to clarify one thing. I was told, and I haven't had a chance to look at these amendments since they've gotten here, that you've taken out any reference to toxic substances. Is that correct?
No.
You have not?
No.
That's still in there?
Did not change that at all.
Okay. Okay, I'm going to limit any questions
Why
on
that
particular. What?
Why were they taking that out?
Well, I guess they weren't. I was just told that at one point that they were considering doing that.
Hmm.
But it's still there, I guess.
I thought at one point I was ready to carry the bill, Mr. Chair.
You thought at one point you were what?
Ready to carry the bill. All these programs.
This is the one that is going to allow you to...
Okay, why don't we begin, wherever you want to begin, Christy, to take us through these amendments.
Okay, would you rather I worked off the...
But you have a copy of the Hand and Gross.
We're sharing a copy here of the Hand and Gross version.
Okay.
Let me tell you, there are also two other people here who may be helpful on technical details. Len Perlman from the Department of Justice, who works with the Health Division as legal counsel, and Ted Falk, who you
right.
heard from earlier, who's
right.
been a member of our AIDS committee.
Okay.
The... find the right... pages. If you'll turn to the fourth page of the bill, you'll see the first major change in the statute, which was to clarify that these more coercive measures that the communicable disease statute allows, such as the consideration of a quarantine, only kick in when voluntary compliance is not obtained. We wanted to make it clear that a local health officer could approach an individual and get voluntary participation, for example, in a tuberculosis treatment program, without having to go get a court order. That was an issue that the county health departments raised. The second part is the underlined section 2 at the bottom of the page is to clarify that this statute doesn't replace existing authority to exclude a child with communicable disease from school or a sick food care handler from working in a restaurant as are already provided for in other statutes and which are put into place from time to time for protection of the community.
Okay, let's...
Wait a minute.
Let's go through this. We're on Section 9, page 4, right?
Yes.
Okay. Can you give me an example of how this would work? Let's, you know, let's deal with an individual X who has AIDS. How would this work? Tell me what would happen.
Well, again, since we think this statute will probably never be used with AIDS, it's a little hard for me to think of the example there.
Well, it can be used.
It could be used with AIDS. If a person with HIV infection were reported to the health division as continuing to engage in promiscuous sex without informing partners, the first thing that would happen under this act is the attempt to get voluntary compliance so that somebody from the public health agency would approach that individual with educational materials, counseling materials, attempt to identify whether they understand the disease, whether they understand what they've been taught about not spreading it to others, do they understand safer sex practices, what is it that's going on with them. If the person, in fact, had not been properly taught and didn't realize what they were doing, and after that education agreed that they had been engaging in inappropriate behavior and ceased it, nothing else would happen under the statute. We would view that as voluntary compliance, and that would be the end. If a person persisted in putting other people at risk, were not insane, so nothing under the mental health statutes would kick in. They were, for example, lying to sex partners about their risk status, and so and therefore not using condoms, for example.
Okay, how would you know that?
This would be by interview with the individual and by interview with those close to them.
How would the health division even be alerted to that?
As I said, the starting point would be a report to us from some place, quite possibly from an individual's physician or from a concerned person in the community, asking us to follow up. If we reach that very, very rare point where we believed that a person was not following voluntary orders, was deliberately putting others at risk, was not being helped by being in a supervised living situation or having family members who'd help them, and we thought we'd exhausted every other resource, then, as this directs, we would go to the procedure outlined in sections 10 and 11 of the statute, the restrictive order, and issue an order that might restrict that person's coming and going, who they could associate with. We might order them to live in a certain very restricted setting or something of that order. Again, because we see that as so very, very rare, we haven't got details of exactly how it might happen, but you might order someone to live in a supervised living situation where their comings and goings could be monitored and they would only go out if accompanied by another. And if we ordered that and the person was unwilling, then we would go through the procedure outlined in sections 10 and 11 to get a court order and get proper review of that restriction.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Van Loo.
On section 9, line 16 in the new section, what are the examples of the contaminant?
That the example that I've used before, and I think it's the one that's most vivid to most public health people in the state right now, is the mercury contamination of a site that was used as an illicit drug lab, and where the owner of the property is refusing to take the steps to clean up that mercury contamination to protect subsequent renters of a house from mercury poisoning. And we might want to issue an order to get that person to clean it up.
With that, I'd like, you know, to ask the committee members, I realize that toxic substances are very important, but the primary concern, at least that the chair has with the bill, is that we address the problem of AIDS, which I think, as important as toxic substances might be, even more important and is the direct purpose of the bill. So I would like us to focus on that particular part of the bill, if at all possible. Okay, Christie, you want to take us through the rest of it?
Okay.
Chair, were you telling me my question was inappropriate?
No, what I'm telling you, Representative Van Loon, if you wish to have me make it clearer, is that a lot of the time in discussion of this bill last time focused on your questions about toxic substances, which I believe may have interfered with the committee's ability to deal with the issue of AIDS. And I would just ask you this time, if at all possible, to limit the number of questions on toxic substances so we can focus on the main issue of the bill.
Okay. Let me just make sure, were there any other questions on that section 2 that rules out the overlap with other statutes? If not, I'll go on to what is page 6, where there's a major section then of new language. What this does, and this addresses one of the concerns that county health departments raised that we went back and fixed while we were working on this, was the issue of perhaps not everybody to whom an official order is issued will want a hearing. The bill as we had originally drafted it said anytime you issue an order there will automatically be a hearing in front of the judge within 72 hours. And on retrospect, when we went back and worked on this with the various interested parties, it was rewritten so that the person has to be told they have a right to a hearing, very clearly told that, but they do not they can say, I don't want that hearing, I'll accept the order and go along with whatever you're doing. And if that's true, and then the court verifies that and they go ahead and issue the final order without the hearing being held. And it takes fairly lengthy language to say all that in proper legal terminology. And you'll see on page 7, the following page, a couple of insertions that simply clarify that, carry that clarification through the rest of that section. All of the little insertions through page, double check what page, through page 12, 13, really page through page 15 are simply insertions to clarify that the following of the order and the subsequent review of the order will take place either if there's been a hearing or if the person has declined a hearing based on which happened to the person, and it just clarifies the choice of terminology to make that clear. But the basic format is the same as the statute was, or as the bill was when you saw it before, that a public health officer on his or her own authority cannot restrict a person to a quarantine ward of a hospital with tuberculosis or to supervised living situation because of AIDS without due process in which the person is clearly told their rights and has had an opportunity for review by a court if they wish that to verify that less restrictive measures have been exhausted and that there is a proper public health reason for the restriction being imposed.
Okay, on section 17, page 15.
Okay, this is the new replacement language provided to deal with the subject of informed consent. And this is a section where you may wish to ask Mr. Falk to join us at the table because I think he knows the commas in this particular section better than any other. For physicians, it makes reference back to ORS 677, which is a statute already on the books that covers physician's responsibility for informed consent, and I think the OMA rightly pointed out that it would be appropriate to cross-reference that statute rather than write new language for physicians. It continues then on page 16 to clarify that there cannot be disclosure except permitted by law, to clarify that persons who comply with this statute is not subject to civil damages, and defines the categories of healthcare providers and so on that would be affected by this section of the statute.
Okay, now I want to go back to section 17, lines 8 and 9.
Yes.
No person shall subject the blood of an individual to an HIV test without first obtaining informed consent.
Yeah.
Okay, now with blood donations, that's considered informed consent at that point,
that's
right?
That's correct.
Okay, now, it was my understanding until last night when I had the misfortune of watching a news program in which three health workers had been infected with the HIV virus by simply coming in contact with the blood of one of the patients.
It was fairly direct contact. I could describe those cases to you.
Right, well, they did describe it. It was fairly direct contact, you're right.
And extensive.
My concern is, though, if I'm a health worker and I'm exposed to blood, and, you know, an accident like, you know, the syringe blowing up, which is one of the things that happened, can I have that blood tested to find out if it's HIV positive?
In a situation like that, the patient would be approached and told that's one of the tests that should be run to get that tested.
I, as the health worker, don't really want to be dependent upon the goodwill of that particular person's blood. I'd like to know. I mean, I'm scared. I'm nervous.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to know. I just, you know, had my arm covered in blood, and I'd like to know whether, you know, I've been exposed to HIV virus. Now, what you're telling me is under this provision that the patient would have to give informed consent first.
That's correct.
And if he did not wish to give that consent, then the health worker is in a position of simply not knowing until sometime in the future when that... You see what I'm saying, Kristen?
I see what you're saying. Even if the healthcare worker knew whether or not that blood was infected, the healthcare worker would not know for a period of 6 to 12 weeks whether or not they had been infected.
Okay, but they could test that blood and put their mind at ease fairly quickly, couldn't they?
If it were negative.
If it were negative.
If it were negative.
Okay. But according to this, though, we'd have to get that individual whose blood it was, their informed consent. And that makes me a little leery.
That is an issue that has been discussed and debated in a number of settings by a lot of folks who've been involved with this, including people who run healthcare facilities, people who work directly with patients. And the general response of those involved is that, notwithstanding that nervousness, the issue of informed consent, of your right to know what test is being done on your body, particularly a test that is as sensitive as this one.
So you would be not in favor then of an amendment, you would not be in favor of an amendment that perhaps exempted exposure by healthcare workers in this particular instance from getting informed consent in those accidental circumstances?
I would not be particularly excited by such an amendment. I think the healthcare worker would have an awful lot to deal with coming back to the patient and saying, by the way, I didn't tell you, but here's what we now know about your status with regard to this with this virus.
Well, I mean, I understand your concern with the privacy of the patient, but I mean, my concern after reading that report last night, hearing that report last night, it indicated that, at least in some circumstances, that I thought it would be impossible for the transmission of the virus. It turns out that it is possible.
Well, those situations, I must add my clarification. I don't think those situations were, in fact, impossible. In the case of the nurse in question, with chapped hands, that means openings on her hands, without wearing gloves, which she should have known to do, she applied direct pressure to a bleeding wound for 20 minutes. That's a fairly direct exposure in a situation in which she failed to follow the recommended techniques that should have protected her. So I guess I'm correcting the impression that it was...
Well, there were three examples.
There were three examples. The most inadvertent of them was the second person who was wearing gloves while drawing blood, and the syringe blew up, and she got blood in her face, in her mouth. Fairly heavy exposure, and was there for several minutes before she could disconnect from the patient and get cleaned up. Between the time of that exposure and the time she became HIV positive, she also had another needle stick injury on the back of her hand from a patient of unknown status. So there may have been another exposure. The third case was also a person who was not wearing gloves while working with blood with a pheresis machine and ended up with blood product up to her elbows with no gloves on, no gown on, and had open sores on her ears and probably had contact that way. So they were not an accidental spatter to the back of your hand while giving a bed bath that could be quickly washed off. They were fairly intensive exposures.
Representative Carter?
In emergency situations where healthcare people don't have the chance to do quick thinking in terms of protecting themselves, but thinking in terms of patients, it appears to me that there need to be some kind of protection for them as well.
There is, and Stevie reminded me, I think there are several cases and case law which says in an emergency situation, we've determined an emergency exists, you can do any number of medical procedures without a specific informed consent. I think the determination would be, is this an emergency? If that healthcare worker who was exposed were in her first week of pregnancy, and she said, I really want to know my status because my risk of infection, because I would seriously consider an abortion if I knew I might become infected and infect my fetus. I think you might construct a case there of an urgent need to know that would be different from another situation where that kind of exposure wasn't there. If you were thinking of doing a transplant from an injured person to someone else, those transplants always involve testing of the blood status.
Is it in statute where they have that protection? The health workers have that in statute?
The emergency, mm-hmm. the various, I'm going to, Ted, would you come?
No.
Okay, then I would join the chair in wanting to see an amendment to this so that there is something in statute to protect those healthcare workers to show in emergency situations. Because if we're going to put this in statute, then convening an amendment.
Mr. Chair, if you're going to do some kind of emergency amendment, then I think we'd be a better look at the how it would be legally. But it isn't just an accident in healthcare workers. Look at the drug scene. Look at someone who might accidentally be infected because of assault mm-hmm. from someone who's infected or raped. There's all kinds of emergencies. I would not like to see anything narrow enough just to take care of the healthcare worker.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
but then there's another point. No matter what you find out, you can't do anything about it. Unlike some of the other testing where there are medical treatments for it at this point.
But in case of pregnancy, there would be.
Yeah.
Okay, let me ask you, I'm sorry, Christy, but I'm going to have to use some far-out examples because this is an area that seems whatever's possible to imagine happens. We do have a person that's been raped. And we have a suspect. Okay, the person has not been convicted. The victim, the rape victim, wants to know whether this individual that raped her is...
Or him.
Positive.
Or him, all right. An AIDS carrier. Okay, now this victim wants to know this. Do we have to get the informed consent of the alleged suspect before a test can be made on him?
My understanding of that discussion in our AIDS policy committee was that it would be very typical for the court to order testing in that case, and the court would have the right to do so. You're involved there with a criminal situation, potential criminal charges, and you would seek that authorization just as you would today to do a venereal disease, any other venereal disease test on that alleged rapist. That's my understanding of that.
That's done rather rapidly, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. the earlier version of this, and it was part of the language that I believe the OMA wished taken out, indicated two exceptions to informed consent, that the individual is undergoing a medical emergency and an HIV test is determined to be necessary, or two, that failure to test could be reasonably expected to pose a serious threat to another individual. And that was a part of the section that got taken out when we rewrote this whole thing after OMA started asking their questions.
Scott, can you comment on that, please?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, basically, the exception for emergency circumstances is set in common law and enables physicians to react in circumstances without informed consent to conduct not only a number of tests, whichever might be necessary, but procedures that would be required in emergency circumstances. It is not specifically defined, and more than likely, the committee is going to have a difficult time in fact determining what an emergency is. The concern is that once you set in statute that an activity is going to take place in an emergency situation, then you place easier into litigation whether or not someone should have conducted a test or whatever, and expose the particular provider to liability that currently doesn't exist. Is, you know, I know that's frustrating for you, but it's also frustrating for the provider as well. And that's the concern of having specific language in the bill of saying, well, here's this exception, this exception, and then trying to, in fact, define in reality in the day-to-day sort of circumstances what that really means without putting the provider in a very difficult position. I think the common law activities that surround dealing with emergency situations really will resolve your concern.
Okay. Representative Van Loon.
In line with the conversation that's just been going on in that amendment on page 15, when we get into subsection 2, it tells us that a physician, even this person's physician, can't have a blood test made unless he obtains the consent of the person, as it gives in subsection 1. That means that the doctor, I mean, thinking of an emergency situation where some health authority or somebody could come in and do something under an emergency, that doesn't even allow the physician to determine whether there's an emergency, unless I'm missing something totally.
Again, my understanding is that we've got very good case law that says that that can be superseded by a physician if the physician is convinced that there's a life-threatening emergency that they need to proceed. That's covered. We don't allow surgery without informed consent, but yet occasionally it happens if there's a determination that's an emergency. I really would like to direct the committee back to what was the original Section 17 in the A. engrossed version of the bill, if it ever got labeled that. It was in the first set of amendments that you adopted. Section 3, A through E, at the bottom of the first page of those amendments. That was where we had originally outlined five exceptions to informed consent. And I would be comfortable with any one or all of those being amended back into the bill. I think my discomfort with what Representative Kotowski, what you suggested earlier, was singling out healthcare workers in some very specific piece, because then you do run into problems defining what is a healthcare worker and what isn't, and so on. But I think this leaves the room for the serious threat to an individual, the emergency medical situation. I respect the problems that Mr. Gallant has outlined. It does mean you've got to make some judgment calls. We could certainly work to provide examples and guidance of what would be in or out of those as examples if they were adopted into the statute to provide some policy guidance to practitioners around the state of Oregon.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, is she referring to where it says no person shall subject the blood of an individual to an HIV test?
Right, section 17 of the amended portion.
Yeah, section three. Subsection.
No, I think I've got the...
Three, A through E.
A through E.
Lines 20 through the end of page one.
And line 22 to line three on the next page could be put in after line nine of the new section 17, I think. Undoes what the OMA had asked us to try to do, which was to get that kind of specific out of the bill.
Okay, now, Scott, you're indicating that under some circumstances, a physician can, could make these tests anyway?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that is my understanding of case law and common law in regard to emergency circumstances. And I need to emphasize again that if, in fact, you start to place into statute exceptions, then you're going to create probably the opposite effect, in my opinion, that you want to create.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ford.